Welcome to Are We Playing God With Our Genes? And my name is Ted Peters, and I teach theology at our Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California. And we have students there who are studying to be pastors, the Master of Divinity program, and then we have, due to our consortial relationship with the Graduate Theological Union, we have doctoral studies programs as well, and that has a number of research centers. And what I want to talk to you about today, and actually this week, comes out of the work of one of those research centers there called the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences. What I plan on doing today is just introducing in 15 minutes sort of my overview of why a theologian would be interested in the subject of genetics, and why it is that I think that our church needs to become alert as to what's happening. There's an advancing frontier in this area of natural science, and there are new discoveries virtually on a weekly basis of real significance. And it's an area of science that is going to expand our horizon of understanding about human nature. It's going to have enormous impacts on healthcare. It's going to have enormous impacts on public policy. And the issues that are coming out of it are much bigger and broader than what the scientists themselves can control or actually, in some ways, even contribute to resolving for society. And so I think, at minimum, those of us in the churches need to be in a position to make some contribution to the public discussion about how this science ought to be used for the betterment of the human race, and how to avoid some potential disasters, economic disasters, moral disasters, and those kinds of things coming down the pike. So that's one motive for getting into this area, becoming informed about the science, and then beginning maybe ahead of schedule to contemplate what might be important for our society. In addition to that, I'm a theologian, and one of the problems with theologians is they have a lot of curiosity. And I've got a lot of curiosity, and I find the science itself, all by itself, exciting, interesting, fascinating. It's just beautiful in many ways. In addition to that, it raises questions that Christians need to think about human nature. We have really have had a stake for centuries in understanding what a human being is. And the kinds of philosophical questions that this science is raising is forcing us to go back to ground zero and ask that question again. What is a human being? And where can we place responsibility and those kinds of things? So I put a little diagram up here that will give you my orientation to the subject matter. What we're going to study basically this week is what I call the gene myth. And by myth here, I mean just a thought structure, a cultural conceptual set that says the following. It's all in the genes. Or the growing belief in genetic determinism. And you can see it in the headlines of articles written about genetic discoveries. The gene for obesity found. And then you read the article, right? Gene is the cause, obesity is the effect. Genetic determinism. The gene myth as a cultural way of thinking is fed by the science. Do the scientists believe the gene myth? Probably on their day off. Not likely in the laboratory. But certainly culturally we believe that it's all in the genes. And there's a certain inherent logic to the gene myth. There's a certain coherence. I have blue eyes. As far as I know, the gene for blue eyes has not been found, but pretty logical that there will be. It will be found. I didn't decide to have blue eyes. And my mother and father didn't decide to have blue that I would have blue eyes. The DNA decided that I would have blue eyes. Suppose I had the gene for Huntington's disease on chromosome number 4, and I contracted that disease. I didn't decide to do that. No, the DNA determined that I would have that particular disease. So there are certain things that I don't have any control of, I don't think, or do I? But my DNA, like a puppeteer, is pulling the strings, and I'm like a puppet dancing. Well, suppose they find the gene for alcoholism. They're that close. And I can say to my wife, oh, gee, I'm sorry that I'm wasting a lot of money this month buying booze, but my genes made me do it. What if I commit a crime such as murder? We're going to talk about murder this week. And I say, well, the reason I committed this crime is I have the gene for Huntington's disease, and one of the symptoms of that disease is to be in a really bad temper, and I committed this murder while I was in a bad temper. Don't blame me, Your Honor. My genes made me do it. I think that we're going to see more and more scientific understanding of genetic determinism, and we're going to see more and more cultural interpretation of genetic determinism in the next half decade. And how are we going to think about that? That's kind of the question that that orients us. And I'm a Christian theologian, and what I want to do as a theologian is ask, hey, what's going on with the gene then? This growing belief in DNA determinism, what's going on there? I want to quiz the scientists and say, hey, does the popular notion that it's all in the genes, is that really scientifically founded or not? Or to what degree is it? That's a reasonable question. But then, as a Christian theologian, I don't want what I have to say about human nature limited to only science and culture. I want to go to our own resources, scripture, our theological tradition. What do we have going there? And a couple of things that I want to ask then are, the first one is, what is human nature? And I have a couple of commitments as a Christian theologian. The first one is that who you and I are essentially as human beings is determined by the resurrected Christ on Easter. It's not determined by soil and spirit back in the Garden of Eden, but it is really determined by the destiny that God has promised for us. Secondly, getting back to the Garden of Eden, I think that one of the characteristics of the human being and the human race as a whole is that we are created co-creators. That is to say, we've been created by God. That is to say, God determined that we would be here. I didn't. You didn't. But on the other hand, creation hasn't stopped. It continues. And we as a human race, and certainly those of us as individuals, are always changing things. Things don't stand still. Things aren't fixed. Things are in process, and we are contributing to that process. Technology, of course, is the big contribution, but even in smaller ways. My wife went to pottery this morning. I trust that by lunchtime she'll have created something. Not de novo, not out of nothing. She will have modified some clay, but that's the nature of the human situation, is that things are changing, they're ongoing, and the question, this leads then to the ethical question, how ought we to be changing things? We don't have a choice to stop change. That's not an alternative. Question is, given change, how are we going to direct it? According to what kind of vision? And what really will make the world a better place? What really will make life for the human race better in the future? So we're going to be talking this week about the science, the gene myth, fundamental Christian commitments, and lots of ethics. And I'll warn you, I've got far more questions than I do answers. And I think that's just where we are in the current situation, where new things are developing weekly, monthly, et cetera. And So part of it is just news, and then the rest of it is how are we going to think about it. Now let me introduce the videotape. We're going to see 30 minutes of videotape in which we're going to do kind of the ABCs of what's going on in the science. As I mentioned before, I teach in Berkeley, and when the Human Genome Project was instituted in 1987 as a government-funded project, there's a lot of it going on in private industry, but when Uncle Sam got into it, Uncle Sam said, some research money needs to go into ethical, legal, and social implications. And so what we did in Berkeley was we got some of the money from Washington to put together a team of theologians and ethicists and philosophers and molecular biologists and behavioral geneticists to try to monitor the research. And so the first 3 minutes of this will be a CNN report on our project in Berkeley. And then it'll switch over to about a 25-minute tape produced by the National Institutes of Health. So if you don't know anything about genetics right now, in 30 minutes you'll know a lot about genetics. And this will introduce the Human Genome Project, and what I'm thinking about doing then, what I know I plan on doing during the week, is to take a look at a number of issues that are arising. And I do have something to pass out here, I just remembered. I'm an absent-minded professor, and that's a problem.
It's in the genes.
It's in the genes. Can I ask a couple of you to just start passing these out so that everybody gets one? Let's see. Would you pass those out? And then give me all the extras. And if you're a couple, maybe you could share one. If you come back, bring it. I don't know if I have enough for everybody. But I do have a quick story about absent-minded professors. This very absent-minded professor was shaving one day in the bathroom, and his wife comes in and reaches into his pocket and pulls out his keys. And then she puts into the same pocket another set of keys. And then she takes a piece of paper and puts it into a shirt pocket. She says, honey, please remember, today is moving day. And after you're done with work, don't come back here. Please go to the new house. I've written down the address of the new house, and it's in your shirt pocket, and the key to the new house is in your pants pocket. Can you remember that? Oh, yes, he said. I'll certainly remember that. So he goes off to the university, and he gives his lectures, and he holds his office hours, and as you can imagine, the glasses come out of the pocket, and the piece of paper falls on the desk, and he doesn't notice it. The day is over, he gets in his car, and he drives where the car would always go, back to the old house. And he goes up to the front door, and he puts the key in the lock, and the key won't fit. Oh, that's right, he says. Today is moving day. Oh my goodness, I wonder where the family moved to. And so he's pondering what he ought to do, and he notices that there's a 10-year-old boy sitting down next to the driveway. And he walks over to the little boy, and he leans down, and he says, young man, by any chance, did you know the family that used to live here? And do you know where it is that they moved to? The little boy looks up and said, come on, Dad, Mom told me you'd forget. Well, at any rate, let's try the videotape and instant.
And pull the screen.
Y'all get it?
Huh? The screen.
Oh, the screen.
I knew you would forget.
Yeah.
It's over there.
Behind me?
You point at that.
Point that way.
Please.
I heard a whine and a whistle.
There it is.
Oh, okay.
Genetic engineering may be the wave of the future in healthcare, but it raises questions, questions among people even outside the field. Theologians meeting in California are trying to answer some of those questions at the request of the federal government. Rusty Dornan has a story in tonight's Focal Point.
What if scientists could alter defective human genes and prevent the onset of some 4,000 hereditary diseases? Would they be playing God or helping the human race? This is just one of the soul-searching questions being raised at the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences in Berkeley, California. The National Institutes of Health have just awarded a $300,000 grant to theologians to ponder the ethical, social, and legal implications of genetic engineering.
Will the new knowledge from genetics change our understanding of God as a creator, especially over against the human being as a creature who was also created?
The grant is part of the $3 billion 15-year Human Genome Project, which is attempting to map every gene on every chromosome. Scientists would like to make the estimated 100,000 genes as familiar as the human skeleton. With this knowledge could come treatments and prevention of everything from Huntington's disease to cancer. But is too much knowledge like opening Pandora's box?
No, I'm not frightened of any new knowledge. I am frightened of misuses of knowledge.
One of the fears is if scientists know an individual's genetic code, then who else will be able to find out?
What will that mean for people's access to the workplace, access to health insurance?
Ethicists are concerned that insurance companies could refuse coverage to those with hereditary diseases, or that an individual might not be hired because of his or her genetics.
The knowledge can also influence the decision on whether to have children. Huntington's chorea, a degenerative neurological disease, runs in Christy Best's family. Christy decided to adopt, but recently discovered she did not have the gene. However, a brother and sister do. Genetic intervention would be a miracle for her family.
If changes could be made to alter this gene so that it would work properly, this is wonderful.
For theologians, it's a first for the federal government to ask their opinion on the moral consequences of genetics.
I think this is quite unique to have scientists and theologians actually talking to each other.
This week is the first of a series of conferences over the next 3 years. Theologians here don't expect to come up with all the answers, but are happy at least the questions are being addressed. Rusty Dornan for CNN, San Francisco.
Discovered the structure of DNA, the famous double helix.
Even equipped with techniques that could convert science fiction into science fact, the Human Genome Project is an undertaking as colossal as it sounds, and is expected to take at least 15 years. The instructions we're looking for are tucked away, in most cases, you can say still hidden away, in nearly every one of the human body's 100 trillion cells. Inside the nucleus of each cell is the complete genetic blueprint for a man or woman. That complete blueprint is called the human genome. The information is contained on 23 pairs of chromosomes, and the chromosomes are mostly made of long chains of a chemical called DNA. It is DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid is the full name, that controls the development and functioning of organisms. DNA contains the genes, in fact, any portion of the DNA chain that contains the instructions for making a complete protein is called a gene. DNA itself contains four bases. They are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. For simplicity's sake, we call them A, G, C, and T. The sequence of these bases, that is, the order in which they're connected, decides the order in which amino acids are linked to form proteins.
As he has moved through the plant further, the question we used to ask is, well, what is a gene? How does it function? These are also semi-theoretical questions. We didn't ask for a specific gene, we just wanted to know the general picture. Now, the objective has gone partial from, you know, understanding the gene, but trying to understand the cell, trying to understand the tissue, an organ. How does your heart really function? How does your brain function? And to really understand that complexity, you really have to know the instructions which make a cell or a tissue or an organ all function in a harmonious way.
We still haven't found exactly where on our chromosomes the overwhelming majority of the genes that make us human are located. We have found some of the genes that cause disease. Cystic fibrosis and neurofibromatosis type 1 are two diseases whose genes
this
have been
Francis
identified
Collins,
by Dr.
Man
Francis
there.
Collins
now
and
the,
his colleagues.
Head of National
Only
Center
of the 100,000 or so human genes can be a disease gene if it contains an error. Most of these genes remain to be identified, and we want to gain this knowledge in our search for treatments and cures. Now, with the Human Genome Project underway, our feet are firmly placed on the pathway toward that knowledge.
The Human Genome Project will attempt to develop a map of genes for all genes of man, and it will attempt to draw together actually the physical characteristics of the physical structures of DNA for that entire map. So it draws together a theoretical map and a physical map. Here's the analogy of a highway that moves from east coast to west coast. Let's assume it's Highway 10 that runs through Texas and begins in Florida and ends in California. If I were to tell you that a gene was on that highway and I only knew the starting and the end point, then I would not have told you very accurately where that gene resides or town resides. However, if I had on that map 25 cities that were clearly mapped on I-10 and I told you that the area we were interested in was between El Paso and San Antonio, then you would know more precisely where to look. And in our search for genes, it is this genetic map of the DNA that enables us to focus on small areas to search for a gene.
Much like finding and noting cities on a map, the Human Genome Project seeks to establish markers on each of the 23 pairs of human chromosomes so that gene hunters can work on smaller and more clearly defined sectors in their search for genes.
Scientifically, there's two major objectives of the Genome Project. One is to get better maps, which means markers along all the chromosomes, which will let you get the gene, the disease-causing gene that you want. For instance, we know that there's a gene on chromosome 17, which when in a mutant form can lead to early onset breast cancer. So one of the things we're doing now is funding people in Houston, Texas, at Baylor, to get an increased number of markers for chromosome 17. Then once you know where your gene is, you've got to sequence it, and we want to reduce the cost of sequencing, so that can be done much faster and easier than it now is.
Sequencing means working out the order of the bases on the DNA strand. The order of these bases is the language of heredity, the actual instructions for physical traits, or how a cell functions, whether it is healthy or not. Sometimes the reordering of any one of the 3 billion base pairs that make up human DNA can mean the difference between health and disease. For comparison, this is the complete genome of the AIDS virus. It is 300,000 times smaller than the human genome and contains only 9 genes. Finding and understanding the 100,000 or more genes buried within the 3 billion base pairs of human DNA will require more complex, more sophisticated, automated technology.
In some cases, we'll probably have to sequence the region of DNA before we can actually spot the gene.
The tools that we used to track down the gene for one's tumor are the precursors to the techniques that the Human Genome Initiative is now developing in a much more sophisticated form. When we started this work about 12 years ago, the only things that we really knew were that patients who had Wilms tumor often had an associated eye condition, the absence or malformation of the iris and iridia, mental retardation, and malformations in the urogenital system. And this group of symptoms was directly correlated with a missing chunk of the 11th chromosome, which could be seen under the microscope. That's all the information that was available. It was a microscopic view of missing DNA. The resolution under the microscope is very crude. One could see that millions of base pairs might be missing, but one couldn't tell which pieces of DNA were critical to the occurrence of the tumor, which pieces of DNA were critical to the defect in the eye, which pieces of DNA were critical to mental retardation, and which pieces of DNA were critical to defects in the urogenital system. So, what we had to do was develop methods for essentially looking in at a finer level of detail than the microscope could provide at the DNA that was missing in each of the patients that we encountered. And those methods basically were methods of gene mapping, ways of putting together a physical map of the DNA on the chromosome that was much more precise than one could get from looking at the chromosomes under the microscope.
In addition to the kind of map we've already seen, the genetic map of markers on the chromosome, gene hunters need a second kind of map, a physical map. These physical maps are created by chemically snipping the chromosomes into pieces, cloning them, and reordering them. Because we know where each piece came from, we can tell where any gene in that piece is physically located. And each piece can be frozen and stored so that we can call for it when we need it for further work at a later time. These physical maps are much more detailed than genetic maps.
After about 5 or 6 years of making finer and finer maps and isolating more and more pieces of DNA within the region that was removed from chromosome 11 in the patients, we started to zero in on a region that was, in our terms, quite small. It still had hundreds of thousands of units of DNA in it, and we knew the gene we were looking for was somewhere in there, but we didn't know exactly where. Find the gene, we had to systematically, chunk by chunk, test the DNA within this 300,000 base pair region for a sequence that was actually expressed as a gene product. And after another couple of years of doing this process, we found one.
For others, the search for genes has been more difficult and has taken them further afield. Such has been the case for the debilitating neurologic disorder called Huntington's disease. Even though scientists know roughly where the gene is located, they have not yet been able to isolate it.
The search for the Huntington's disease gene is probably the most perverse story in medical genetics today. And I think that story really exemplifies why you needed a united approach to finding disease genes. The Huntington's story, in a way, was the jumping off point for the Human Genome Project, because I think through that story, we learned about the power of these techniques to find genes. But we also learned how tremendously difficult it is and why you need a united, organized, uniform approach with international collaboration to try to expedite the project and make it cost effective. I actually got into this story for very personal reasons, because in 1968 my mother was diagnosed with Huntington's disease. And this was a disease that I knew had killed my three uncles, but I think that we all thought my mother was going to escape this disease. So it was kind of a shock for everybody. And my sister and I each learned that we had a 50-50 risk of inheriting the disease. Now, one of the problems when we started out was that in all of existence, there was one DNA marker. So we were talking about finding maybe hundreds of thousands of markers before we would find the one we wanted. Two was that we needed to study a very big family. Because since you can't see the gene, the only way that you can find if this marker is near the gene is to watch the markers traveling together with the genes through families. Well, the United States of America, it's not so easy to find families with 10 and 20 and some odd kids. So off we went to Venezuela, where we heard about the largest family in the world with Huntington's disease. And we began just looking, counting noses. Who has Huntington's, how many kids? And these are big families. These are 18 kids in the family. One man has 34 kids. Now all of this, we took blood samples, we sent everything back, and lo and behold, much to our total shock and amazement, I mean, complete. In 3 years of study, despite everybody's predictions that it would take 50 or 75 years to find this thing, in 3 years, Jim Gazzella and Mike Keneally and a number of other people had found in the Venezuelans and an American family a little tiny marker that was extremely close to the Huntington's disease gene, right up on the top of chromosome 4. And we said hallelujah, and there was celebration in the streets, and there was press throughout the world, and India, and Venezuela, and you name it, there was press. I mean, it was just astonishing. So we were clever, thought, any minute now we find a gene. The problem has been that this particular gene is way up on top of a chromosome that is very peculiar. If the Human Genome Project had been done when we started, we'd be there, because even on Mount Everest, we would have had tents all the way up and down, we would have known where we were going, we would have had markers galore. It would have been easy to travel up and to find the region that we were looking for. It would have been a matter of months of finding the gene. Other people won't have this kind of tough luck. And when the project is here, for many other different disease genes, they're going to be able to just look it up in a book.
From a social point of view, looking it up in the book will be the beginning of the story, not the end. When a disease gene is found, it is often likely that a test will be developed to tell people whether they have the gene. This could happen long before there is a cure or treatment for the disease the gene causes. It brings up a set of problems that the Human Genome Project is keenly aware of.
There are a lot of questions which come up, like how to keep the privacy, then what to do, which is a separate issue, when it's clear that someone suffers from a disability, such as Huntington's disease. How do you protect someone who has a serious, and those people who suffer from genetic diseases, what we've got to be worried about is that, you know, they suffer from it for what I call, you know, I'm just throwing the genetic dice. In any given family, if the disease is in the family, some of the children get it, some of it don't. It's just random, depending on which of the two chromosomes you might get donated by your mother or your father. So those who suffer from, I'd say, are victims of unjust throes of the Mendelian process. And you can't subject them to a double whammy, that not only are you going to have not as full potential for a healthy life, but they will be discriminated against jobs, and they might even be discriminated before they came down with the disease.
We can prepare to deal with genetic discrimination in jobs, in insurance, and in schools, wherever it may exist. We must also prepare a social framework to handle the impact of our new findings and new technology. A framework that did not exist when screening programs began more than 20 years ago for sickle cell anemia, an inherited disorder that mainly affects black people.
The Human Genome Project can benefit from the experience that we've had in sickle cell anemia by noting the conditions under which those who were leading those screening programs failed to take into account social and or even political factors that go to promote certain kinds of activities or certain kinds of actions. So for example, in the sickle cell program, we did not bring in the community when we were planning the screening programs, when we were getting ready to set them up. And so consequently, what happened was that many people opposed the programs, or many people misunderstood the programs, or many people thought that they could deliver things that they couldn't deliver because they didn't understand and weren't properly prepared. And those forces will have to be analyzed, will have to be studied, will have to be understood in the context of any programs of screening and genetic testing as well. And finally, the control of genetic information. I mean, in the early days of sickle cell testing, there were proposals that all sickle cell testing should be sent to a central repository, should be put on computers so people could tap into it. They were sending the results of sickle cell tests to schools so that the teachers would know which children had sickle cell trait and which had the disease and so forth, and because they thought that would help them somehow deal with the children. All it did was end up stigmatizing those children, and the teachers used those as excuses. Well, that kid's not doing well, but then he has a sickle cell trait, and so we don't expect those children to do well. Totally a wrong information.
The impact of the Human Genome Project is extraordinarily complex, and I'm not so Pollyanna as to say that it's going to be totally without problems. In fact, I think that the National Center for Human Genome Research is very prescient in saying there will be problems, let's think about them before they're upon us. For this reason, they have a program called the Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues Program. There's a working group specifically for this area, which I have the privilege of chairing. And the specific issues that we're looking at are ways in which to allow people to take advantage of the information that the Human Genome Project will develop and try to avoid some of the deleterious aspects.
You know, it'd be nice to believe that we could stop genetic injustice, but one thing that's, you know, as certain as taxes is that the replication of genes when they're copied is there's never a perfect process. So there are always going to be new imperfections created because the process isn't perfect. And the reason that evolution hasn't yielded a perfect process, because if DNA replication was perfect, you would throw off new variants who might survive better as the environment of the Earth changes. So evolution demands a certain low but finite range of mistakes, with some of the mistakes leading to a better chance of surviving, but that was leading to less chance of surviving. So the mistake process is always going to go on, and what we've got to do is to protect those who inherit their mistakes. The 21st century is going to sort of accept the fact that genes provide the instructions and start with that instruction book and, you know, ask other questions such as, how do all the gene products interact to allow the development of a human being from a fertilized egg up to an extraordinary creatures we are as adults. I mean, humans, when you really think about everything we do, we're very remarkable. And studying with the genome, we're going to understand, I think, more and more the extraordinary subtleties which, at the molecular level, which underlie the subtleties of human existence.
We are embarked on a journey into the details of human heredity. As the Human Genome Project continues, the treasure map will become more and more clear. Each new discovery will add another piece to our understanding of the complex and marvelous genetic puzzle that makes up humankind.
Take a look at the green sheet, and I'll mention the topics and some of the issues that come up, and what it's going to look like during the week as we talk about this. What we did today is introduce the Human Genome Project and try to provide a little background for the science. What I want to do tomorrow, and I think it's a Tuesday afternoon event. You can come and go as you feel like. But the first two issues I want to deal with, there's genetic discrimination. You heard Jim Watson on the tape use the word privacy. And then a few paragraphs later, he used the word discrimination. What we can reasonably anticipate will be a new form of discrimination in our society against people who have defective genes. But defective is really going to be defined as expensive, that somebody is going to have to pay for these bad genes. And when we see that our health care is covered by private insurance, and the private insurance is connected with employment, we've got a situation that is just ripe for what Watson called the double whammy. That on the one hand, because of the throw of the genetic dice, you end up with some bad genes. And then secondly, you get clobbered by society, you might not be able to get a job, you might not be able to get health care coverage. One of the things we can imagine that would be wonderful in the future would be able to take your and my genome and put it on a card like a Visa card, right? You move to a new town, you give your genome to your new physician, he or she puts it in the old computer, and you're ready for preventative health care. That's the upside. Downside is your employer will want to see that genome too. Puts that in the computer, finds, gee, you've got 8 expensive genes. You've got the gene for Alzheimer's disease. You've got the gene for inherited breast cancer. You've got the gene for late onset diabetes. Well, you see, we can't hire people with those genes because our insurance carrier won't cover people with those genes. Now, that sounds a little bit extreme, but already, genetic discrimination is occurring in isolated areas. We do not as yet have the legislation to protect. And there may just be, we just may be on a collision course between the needs for medical care for people with genetic and the way healthcare is funded in the country. And so that needs to be discussed, sorted out. And of matters regarding urgency in Congress, this is probably number one on the list. It was already there when James Watson was trying to get the U.S. Congress to vote in the $3 billion budget for this. It was already a matter of concern, and so we need to talk about that. That relates directly to issue number two over abortion. I'm not going to talk about abortion in general, but note how genetic research is going to shift some of the parameters of the abortion debate. As Jim Watson was predicting, with the discovery of each genetic predisposition to a disease, the next thing that's going to happen is we're going to look for a test to find out whether you and I have that disease gene. What happens if we end up with 100 tests, 200 tests, 300 tests, 400 tests? And suppose we can administer these genetic tests prenatally. We'll know well before a child is born what defective genes he or she has. We'll know which kids to abort ahead of time. We know right now that Down syndrome, which is caused by three copies of chromosome 21, that when prenatal tests are run, 8 out of 10 of those fetuses are aborted. Okay, multiply that by 400 more diseases. What will be the criteria by which some children are brought to term and others are aborted early because of their genetic formulas? What about the insurance industry? Will they be demanding that we abort and provide us with a computer printout of those genetic formulas that get aborted and those which are permitted to come to full term? What's going to happen in the future regarding selective abortion? The patenting of intellectual property. Before I started my research, I thought that was a boring topic. Then I got really into it and I found it exciting, and now that I'm done researching it, I find it boring again. So we'll probably skip that and substitute cloning for that. The cloning controversy is, if you even glanced at a newspaper since February 22nd, has just been a worldwide controversy. And so we'll spend some time spelling out just what are the issues in the cloning debate, and just where President Clinton's proposed legislation to deal with cloning is currently. Numbers 4 and 5 deal with the gene myth directly. Is it likely that if we can find genes that predispose us towards diseases, we could find genes that predispose us towards behaviors as well? And what if some of those behaviors are antisocial? What if there are behaviors that would lead us towards violence, perhaps, or that might lead us towards alcoholism, or might lead us towards some kind of undesirable social behavior? What about the Christian doctrine of original sin? Is that relevant? I mean, theologians tried to get rid of it as an embarrassment over the last 100 years. You mean it's coming back through science? Is science now teaching what the theologians tried to put on the shelf and hide? That we have a biological predisposition towards evil? Is that coming back? Fair question. What happens if we can identify genes for bad behavior before people engage in bad behavior? Would that stigmatize them in some fashion or another? Would we begin making judgments about people before we observe what they do, but on the basis of our knowledge of their genome? Why not? I will give you a case with regard to Huntington's disease on that, which that's an example. But certainly when we think about the future of the court system, wherein defendant after defendant is going to claim innocence on the grounds of my genes made me do it, I'm not making this up, it's already happened. It is happening right now. Are you going to judge these people guilty or innocent for their crimes if they were genetically determined to do that? Do you think that genetically caused criminal behavior is sort of like insanity? Does that mean that perhaps we should take people with genes that dispose them to crime and just put them in mental hospitals? One thing about being judged insane and put in a mental hospital is eventually a psychiatrist could judge you sane and then let you out, right? But your DNA is with you until you die. And why bother waiting until you go through the court process? We could just test babies when they're born, right? And find out if they got crime genes and send them straight to the mental institution, leave them there for the rest of their life. Is that what a liberal society is likely to do? How will we handle legally issues of that particular nature? I find these interesting puzzles. They shouldn't keep you up late at night worrying about these things, but they are intellectual puzzles of some significance. What about the gay gene? We'll talk about the discovery of what they call the gay gene on the X chromosome in 1993. What will be its impact on our ethical thinking? If you and I have a genetic predisposition towards homosexuality, can we rightly call it natural? If it's natural, does that mean God put it there? If it's natural, does that mean it can claim some sort of moral high ground? Do natural things have to be honored, or can we change them? And if we can change them, by what criteria do we want to make those changes? If homosexuality turns out to be natural, I wonder if heterosexuality might turn out to be natural as well. A lot of heterosexuals in this world, perhaps a genetic predisposition for that will be discovered. What about homophobia? Might there be a genetic predisposition for that as well? We need to ask the question, will knowledge gained through science about genetic predispositions to sexual behavior count as we think ethically, morally, theologically? I don't know the answers to these, by the way, so if you think you're going to come back and get all the answers, sorry about that. But we're in a period of time in which getting the questions out is worth something. Somatic therapy versus germline intervention. This is an esoteric topic. But five European countries already have laws against it. It's a crime that's never been committed. What's going to happen in America when scientists consider engineering the human genome in such a way that it might influence generations into the future? It's one thing to use genetic therapy to try to heal a disease. It's another thing to think that we might actually contribute to the evolution of the human race. Should we do that? Which leads then to the final issue, are we playing God? Part of the gene myth has a commandment to it. The commandment is, thou shalt not play God. Thou shalt not monkey with nature. Out of an arrogant human pride that somehow or other could create an enormous amount of damage. That's built right into the gene myth. What does that mean? The commandment against playing God doesn't come from any theological resource that I know of. But it's a very secular idea. But as Christians, how ought we to think about that? And just really what ought to be a good, healthy relationship to the advancement of science, the advancement of technology, and what kinds of ethical directions should society be giving us? Anyway, those are the kinds of issues that I want to work with during the week, and I'm just going to take another minute or so. And then we'll end our discussion. The bookstore asked me to say a couple things about supporting reading materials that we have there. I asked them to get Playing God, which comes directly out of this research project that you saw on the videotape, and it deals with the gene myth. In its broad scope, what is it that causes it, what in the sciences, etc. And then it has a chapter on the gay gene and a chapter on this legal question as to whether or not we can blame our genes in the courts and be innocent. It talks about Christian freedom, how is it that we should understand Christian freedom, and whether or not Christian freedom has got anything to do with freedom in the public sector. It's that old determinism freedom debate, which the church had for 1,000 years, then kind of gave it up, and it's coming back again through science, which I think is sort of an interesting curiosity. And it raises the question of how much responsibility should we in our present generation have for the life of future generations. The book on sin deals with sin in its just general sense, and I ask the question here, what is it that we do when we're sinning? And I assume that all of us sin, and if you're engaged in it, what does it look like? Towards the end of the book, I have a chapter on genes and sin, and trying to work through the implications of genetic research for the Christian concept of sin. Then finally, for the love of children, the subtitle is Genetic Technology and the Future of the Family. And this book argues that because of the advance of genetic research and reproductive technology, children that come into the world in the future are much more going to be the product of choice than they were in the past. That's just the nature of the advance of technology. And as we think about the ethics surrounding family life and the place that children have, we're going to have to put more and more weight on the decisions that people make. And I think we have good Christian resources there for dealing with it. It's the concept of covenant or promise. I think that the reliance on the genetic continuity between parents and children in the future is just going to begin to dissipate. It's not going to be there like it was in the past. And so more and more we're going to find that we're going to need criteria for choice. So I take up the issue of selective abortion and alternative ways of bringing children into the world. Artificial insemination by donor, in vitro fertilization, surrogate motherhood, and all of these ways in which the relationship between parents and children is going to get increasingly complex. And I suggest that the real definition of what makes a family is probably less founded on biological connection and much more founded, really, at least for Christians, on how it is that God wants us to relate with one another. And I personally think biology plays, relatively speaking, a small role in that. So that's the kind of an argument that you're going to get.